is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, this is Brendan Winters from Pro Skills Basketball, and you are listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
What'd you do today? Well, I shot for an hour, and that's it. Matching work habits against the elite. I mean, when you think you've done something, you need to do some more. I mean, that's just what it is.
Jay Smith is currently the Director of Player Personnel and Development at the University of Michigan under Juwan Howard. Smith has over 3 decades of collegiate basketball coaching experience on all 3 NCAA levels. Early in his 34-year coaching career, Smith was an assistant coach at Michigan for 7 seasons, from 1989 to 1996, where he helped the Wolverines to 6 NCAA tournaments, 2 Final Fours, and assisted in recruiting what some consider to be the greatest class ever recruited, the famed Fab Five. During his time in Ann Arbor, he aided in the coaching of All-Americans Ramil Robinson, Loy Vaught, Terry Mills, Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, and Juwan Howard. Prior to his return to Michigan, Smith spent the past 3 seasons as the head coach at Kalamazoo College from 2016 to 2019. Before returning to a head coaching role in Kalamazoo, Smith was an assistant coach at the University of Detroit Mercy for 8 years, from 2008 to 2016, after taking 2 years away from the game following his stint as the head coach at Central Michigan. In his near decade with the Chippewas, Smith led CMU to a pair of Mid-American Conference regular season titles in 2001 and 2003, along with the 2003 MAC Tournament Championship and a trip to the NCAA tournament led by eventual NBA player Chris Kamen. Before heading to Mount Pleasant, Smith earned his first head coaching job at Grand Valley State University in 1996. Smith started his coaching career as an assistant at Kent State for 5 years from 1984 to 1989, where he helped the Golden Flashes to a pair of NIT appearances in 1985 and 1989. Smith played 1 year of college basketball at Bowling Green State University from 1979 to 1980 before playing his final 3 seasons at Saginaw Valley State. Smith was a standout high school basketball guard at Mayo Asable High School and still holds the Michigan State record for career scoring with 2,841 points, a record that he set without the three-point line. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and Cavalier Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We are unbelievably excited for the content we're going to be bringing you in the weeks ahead as more of our new shows come to life. If you've ever thought of hosting your own basketball-themed podcast or a pod that covers an NBA team, we want to hear from you about joining our great lineup of show hosts. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Jay Smith from the University of Michigan.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Suckel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from the University of Michigan, a former assistant coach at Kent State while I was playing there, Jay Smith. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Excited to be here.
We are thrilled to have you on. I'm personally excited to be able to go back and talk a little bit about our time together and just dive into all the different experiences that you've been able to have in the game. But I want to start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Talk to me a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with it?
Wow. Man, you're going to – geez, I turned 59 here on Sunday, so we've got to dial it way back. So when I started, believe it or not, my dad played basketball at the high school called Mayo Asable High School in the northern part of lower Michigan. And my dad held the scoring record My brother came along and broke it. My sister then went on and earned a scholarship at Michigan to play women's basketball. Then I came along and actually broke the scoring record in high school. But I'm going to dial it even further back. When I was growing up, I was like most kids. Like I, you know, I was tall and lanky. My body, I was tripping over my damn feet all the time. I had a problem. Frick, I slobber pushed everywhere. I mean, I was still trying to figure out how my body worked. But I was pretty tall for my age. I started playing basketball. I really fell in love with it. And I was in Grayling, Michigan. I remember going down when I was in elementary school in third, fourth grade down to the outdoor courts and trying to get in on the game because I was taller than most fourth graders. And shoot, I think I was 6'3 in sixth grade. So I was tall and I was just wanted to get in and run once or twice with the big boys. And that kind of got me into it. And then we moved to where I ended up graduating from in Mayo. And there was a guy by the name of Del Wubinaw who coached at Clearwater Christian College. Believe it or not, that's the home of Pete Maravich. That's where Pete Maravich ran his basketball camps. And Del Wubinaw got me really involved in. I still talk to him to this day. They actually named the court after him at Clearwater Christian College. So he got me going along with my dad. I mean, my dad played a huge factor in that because he played at we had an old basket on the side of the house. And honest to God, we live in a town of probably less than 500 people. And it's all we did was, you know, hell, that was the only thing to do. Like I didn't like football, loved to shoot it, loved to play out in the driveway, all kinds. At night, we had one dimly lit light. And God, we'd be out there playing all the time. And I'd be shooting to the point of, I had two balls in the wintertime, and you didn't have open gym, guys. Like Jason and my, you guys have open gyms. There wasn't a such thing as an open gym. And I had two balls, and I'd go, you know, get so cold outside in winter, I'd shovel the driveway off and shoot. And then I'd go get my other ball, bring it back out. That was too, it wouldn't dribble anymore. So I brought the other one out. I could shoot with that. That would get cold. I keep changing them in and out. And you made do with what you have, and you didn't know. You know, maybe we were poor, but I didn't know it. Like, I didn't know. It's like, this was the way we did it. And you just played ball. And believe it or not, as I came up through the ages, obviously I grew. I was like 6'5 in eighth grade. And I got to be the 10th man on the varsity team in the summertime as an eighth grader, which really helped me because I got to play against high school kids all summer long. And they didn't have team camps back then. And what we did is we loaded in a van and you go travel to Traverse City and go play the Traverse Cities, the Oscodas, the Tawa schools through northern Michigan. And you just go play Gladwin down south toward Bay City. And you just played those teams. That's how you did it. And we'd load up and go. And the coach would play the first five. And then I was part of the second five. And I got to play really a full game every time we stopped. I got to play four full quarters and played and enjoyed the heck out of it. And my ninth grade year, I was ready for the varsity. And I want to say this, like, we had a great group of guys. Like every school, every year I played, we just had great teammates. Like they were fantastic. And back then, I ain't gonna lie, it was about winning. It wasn't about a scholarship or social media. We didn't have any of that. We had real films. Like you didn't have any of that stuff. So I mean, that was, you know, made it. And you just grew close to the guys and the experiences. And we traveled all over northern Michigan. And all of a sudden, the ninth grade year, I got to start on the varsity team and averaged like 15 a game. And that group, we were 25-1. We were undefeated, lost in the quarterfinals, lost in the regional finals, made a heck of a run at it. And then it was my sophomore year, averaged about 26 a game. And we lost again in the regional finals. My junior year, I jumped it up to about 36 a game, and we lost in the semifinals, the final four in the state of Michigan. And then my senior averaged like 37 a game and lost in the quarterfinals just before the semifinals. So I had a fantastic career, but it was because of the teammates and the guys I played with, because they would literally bitch like crazy if I wasn't shooting. I mean, they would be like, God, I mean, they would cuss at me at halftime, and I'm sitting there, dudes. And I already have one time I had 59, I had like 37 and a half, and I was still getting, guys were pissed I wasn't shooting enough. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, oh, I mean, it's
those kids today would kill for those teammates, coach.
I know, but they were, you know, guys that we grew up with. They never transferred. They were committed. We grew up together since third grade. You know what I mean? It was one of those.
Absolutely.
You, you know, it was community back then in the schools. Nobody looked at transferring. I mean, you were committed to your school because you lived there. I mean, that's what was commitment back then. And now kids are jumping around and, you know, it's just changed that way. But there was a real love and a passion, and, you know, it was small town basketball, but it was great. We would travel downstate and play, but I can't say enough about that. But really didn't – I went to like two basketball camps in my whole life. One was the University of Michigan, but Johnny Orr, we came down, and this is a true story. So they brought – it was like an elite camp. We had all the best players. God, we had Tim Andre, Don Wanzel, Derek Perry. We had Plummer, who played at Golden State, went to Boston U. There was a bunch of players. Well, the awards were like they had one-on-one and free. I won the free throw shooting contest, and Johnny Orr paid me $20. He gave me $20. That was the reward. I'm like, they handed out cash back then. So yeah, it was good. No, it was good. I was truly blessed. I just had great, great teammates. I can't say that enough. Like, they're my lifelong friends, guys that stood up in my wedding, just really cared more about, you know, the process of winning than just winning. But it was about the school pride. It was about the school, stood for the right stuff all the time. So, but I had a great, I can't, you know, and I played all the time. I played baseball and I played basketball. I ran some track. I didn't play football because I was 6'6", 6'5" and a half and about 120 pounds soaking wet. And I'm like, they will kill me. They will freaking kill me. Those guys, I saw our offensive line. I'm like, there's no way. I'll die out here in football. So, but I enjoyed it. I really did. I had a great career.
Well, I love what you said about your teammates and just the fact that it's the guys that you grew up with, because that's something that I always point to. I tell people from the time I was in maybe third or fourth grade, I had a pretty good idea of who the guys were going to be that I was going to end up playing high school basketball with. And there was never a thought in my mind of, I'm going to go to this school, or I got to go here because they play a better schedule, or I'm not sure if I'm going to get enough exposure here. It's just, I wanted to play with my friends. There was never a doubt of where I was going to go to school. And as a result of that, you build up that bond, that camaraderie that you described that I think today, in a lot of cases in high school, is missing. Because I feel, and again, you probably have a better pulse on this than I do, but it feels like, especially at the high school level, when you combine that with the AAU summer stuff, it seems like it's much more of an individual agenda in terms of, I'm not necessarily looking at having success as a team in my high school career. I'm more looking at, what can I achieve within the confines of my AAU team or my high school team so that I can get that next opportunity to go to college? I always feel bad for kids today in a sense that it always feels like, and I'm not even sure if it's the kids or parents or exactly where it comes from, but it always feels to me like everybody's always looking at the next thing instead of just enjoying the moment. Like, I could hear when you're talking, like, it's clear the passion that you have for that time in your life and for those guys that you played with. And I think if you ask somebody who's 17 now, when they're 59, to look back on their high school career, I'm not sure they're going to have those same feelings for their school, for their teammates, for the situation. To me, that's kind of a little bit sad.
It is. And partly to do with, you know, the way this thing is laid out. I mean, we were able to, I mean, I'm a big multi-sport guy. I think it's really important that you, but anymore, sometimes you have to specialize. And it's nothing bad, but it's like, you got to specialize. So you don't get those experiences. But, you know, we loaded up in vans and we go to Traverse City and buy a lug of cherries and threw spit cherries at each other. And that's the stuff that bonded. And everybody's like, well, we got to do team building. We did that. We didn't even know we were doing it. I mean, we were, you know, it was more a love and appreciation for one another. And I think, you know, that boils down to some really simple values that sometimes get lost in all this. Like, it, you know, everybody's so geared on the end product. Can I get a scholarship? I mean, that's, that is the driving force. I didn't even know what a scholarship, I'm like, this is how naive I was. I mean, I visited Michigan. I visited Bowling Green, Ball State, Northern Illinois, Central Michigan. I didn't really understand the process. I was enjoying the hell out of it. I know that. I was like, this is great. I mean, I got on my first plane and, you know, I wasn't sure exactly what I was doing with the thing. I kind of went to Bowling Green kind of cold turkey because I liked the locker room. I wasn't paying attention. But, Mike, honestly, Jason, I mean, they didn't have the internet. You didn't have all the information that kids have today. Like, I mean, if you
that is so true. I told when Coach Grube was on, I talked to him about my experience going to Kent. And I remember talking to Coach McDonald before my senior year and showing some interest and kind of thinking about it. And then at some point, I believe it was in the fall there of my senior year, he asked me to come down and take an official visit to come down. And I remember saying to him, no, I don't want to take an official visit, because in my head, I was still waiting for Ohio State to call and Duke to call and North Carolina. And here I was going into the fall of my senior year. And just like you said, I had no idea that I was completely out in left field, that there was no chance that that was going to happen. I wasn't aware of it. My parents weren't aware of it. My high school coach wasn't necessarily aware of it. And so I turned down that visit. I still remember coming down and being in the coach's office and having a conversation. Then my mom and I going to Wendy's on campus and eating lunch ourselves that we paid for. And then after that, it was kind of like, okay, the recruitment of Mike pretty much ended at that point. And then I had to go ahead and recruit myself as the season went on. And then obviously eventually it all worked out for me. But just like you, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. I mean, because the information just wasn't out there.
Right. I mean, it's one of those ones where you got to stay educated. You know what? I always go back to, what are the things that really make you happy? And to me, it was playing. It was playing and the people I was with. And sometimes, Mike, we get caught up into how big is the arena? You know, all the things, what kind of shoes they are wearing, all the things that really don't matter when you come down to it, in valuing education. And that's where I say today's day and age, a little bit, we have to remember that, you know, you're getting an education. And to me, that's where it starts. I mean, that has to be at the forefront of what college athletics, you know, leaving here with a degree from the University of Michigan is huge. I mean, that could pave a way for you for a lifetime. And you can be whatever you want to be. I heard one podcast say, what would you be if every profession paid a dollar?
That's a great way to look at it.
And all of a sudden, guys are, well, I'd be a doctor. Well, then damn it. Like, that should be your goal.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, and not just what's the easiest way or good sports manage because it's easy, but if every profession paid a dollar, what would you be? And that's a great point, you know?
It's a great way to frame your life.
Yeah. Like, it makes a lot of sense. But I mean, you know, and we all have, I don't want to ruin anybody's dream. I think, like, for you, Mike, I mean, you dream big. I mean, you wanted to. I mean, that's okay. But in the end, when you start looking back and you can pass along experience and stuff, to me, it's all about, like, the friendships, the relationships, the people that you went on the journey with that you, like, I tried to during this pandemic, and I think I told you this, Mike, I called for about 2 months. I tried to call 4 people that I haven't really touched base with in a while. And one was Jim McDonald, but there were several coaches along the way that I just wanted to touch base with that. You know what? You get so wrapped up in this thing that you forget. And this gave me time to reflect. I think a lot of good came out of it for me. It helped me and got me some great conversations, and it was really good. And I just think some of that stuff is, you know, that relationship stuff is such a huge part, because I think it was my dad at 7, you're laying there and it's all over with. It's going to be your family and the people that you shared experiences. That's what you're going to take with you, not your goods, you know?
So true. And I think that we look at this time especially, and I think it all depends on your frame of mind and how you look at it. And there's a lot of people out there that we've been fortunate enough to talk to that have looked at this situation where they've been away from their teams or their career, and they've spent more time with their family. They've sort of been able to reevaluate where they are. And then just like you, they've decided, hey, I'm going to do something to grow as a person, to improve my relationships, to do those things that maybe in the hustle and bustle of my everyday life when things are normally going on, I don't stop to think about it, or I just don't take the time, or I don't think I have the time. And now, none of us has the excuse that we don't have time. That excuse is completely out the window, because we all know we have plenty of time. And so I think the people that really care about improving themselves and doing those kinds of things, they're looking for ways to be able to do what you described, which is, hey, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to call 4 people a day that I haven't reached out to in a long time. And again, just think about the value I'm sure that's brought to your life during this time.
Oh, it's been, and one was like Frank Kurtz. I don't know if you remember
him. Yeah, absolutely.
I reached out to Frank and I reached out to Jim McDonald, but some other ones. And I've been fortunate to have cancer here over the last year and a half. And it's changed me. Like it makes you reflect. It makes you think twice about things, how you live your life, what you do, what you say, where you're going, appreciate things. You forget, you let the little stuff go. I was blessed with it. I told somebody, I mean, good Lord gave it to me for a reason. And it has been good. It's helped me. Like I don't use it as a negative. I use it as a positive. I'm not trying to pound my chest on it, but it does make you reflect, and it gets you in touch with what's really important in your life. Like sometimes, you know, in this profession of basketball, in this high level basketball, can absolutely consume you. And I've seen a lot of guys go down to the wayside because of it. Like it can overcome you, and you think you're the world beater, but it's not how it, you know, there's a bigger plan. There's a bigger guy than us out there, man. That's my faith coming out, but it's like it changes. And I just been blessed with it, you know. I have, and I it's been a blessing for me, and I take it that way. And I've been fortunate, and like I said, it makes me think of things differently. And I'm just blessed. Like I said, I'm glad I had it. I'm glad I'm going through it. And I got a 6-month checkup and I'm clean and I'm good.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's awesome. And when it resets your mindset, your priority, I think that's really where you find out what's important in your life and who's important in your life. And it's, again, not that you'd wish that on anybody, but by the same token, I think what I've heard you say now twice is that you take what potentially some people could look at as a big negative, and you've turned it into something that has been spun positive. And I think for anybody, the lesson there is, you know, you can look something that could be really dark right in the face and be able to turn it into something that helps you to grow and be a better person and have better relationships and continue to move on and prioritize. And so I think that's something that we can all take a lesson from. Let's jump from that serious topic. Not that playing isn't serious, but go back to your college career. Just give us maybe a highlight or two, something that you remember that stands out from your time playing college basketball.
Wow. Well, I was a small town guy going down to what I thought was the big city in Bowling Green, and ended up going there and played there for a year. I didn't have a great experience. I had great guys. I just got a text from guys. We're getting together August 22nd to reconnect with all of them, you know, and great players. But playing, you know, it was tough on me. I didn't I didn't have a lot of a good base, I should say. Guys were ahead of me as far as what was going on, and I was still adjusting to. I mean, we had 43 kids in my class. We had 500 people in the whole town. I mean, I went to my first lecture. There's 500 people in the whole darn building, you know? So I'm like, wow, like this. And back then, you didn't have anybody helping you. You know, now you got like, I help our guys. I've talked to our freshmen almost every other day before they even get here. So, but like you were trying to figure it out with anybody helping you, you know, and that was tough. So after the year, after I played, I earned my letter, but I wasn't comfortable. So I went to a Division II school in Saginaw Valley and really enjoyed it. Had 3 good years, you know, a couple hours from home. It was a little bit slower paced campus. Wasn't as big. Really good for me. I had really good coach. We are lifelong friends. He came to my dad's funeral. He's helped me through some tough situations. We've become really good, really, really good friends. Had 3 years, was all conference, was captain for a couple of years, but enjoyed it. But wanted to, you know, that was kind of the end of it. Like I wasn't looking to try it. I wanted to get into coaching. Like that was in my blood. I knew at an early age that I wanted to coach. And I told my dad, I was like, well, you're going to be broke. I'm like, oh well, it might be, but I'm going to like what I'm doing because I see my dad climb telephone poles for 20 years. And I'm like, I sure in the heck don't want to do that. Like I want to get my education and I want to either teach and coach or I'm going to get into college coaching. And I was very, very fortunate. After my playing career, I applied to a bunch of places. And Jim McDonald, who ended up being your coach, Mike, had a GA spot open. And I came down and interviewed with him. scared the living daylights out of me. I'm not going to lie, man. Oh, Jimmy Mack could come at you, couldn't he?
Absolutely. Woo! Absolutely.
But I knew enough about, you know what, I think one of the reasons, I knew enough about OER, offensive efficiency and DER stuff. I did that at Saginaw Valley. I understood it. I think it kind of captured him, like, hey, this guy kind of knows what I'm doing. And I kind of, he showed me some numbers, and I think I impressed him with knowing some of the knowledge of it. He ended up hiring me as a GA. So I left there, Mike, and I moved from my house up in Saginaw Valley to Kent State. I lived in a studio apartment, and I made $353 a month. $255 went for rent. So I would go to the local happy hour, I know, as a GA, and I'd go over at, like, they had happy hour from 6 to 8. I know I could buy a Coke, and I could get free wings and Doritos at Shenanigans over there at Kent State.
Yep.
I could eat dinner for free. So that's how I survived.
This is the glamorous life of a college basketball coach, correct?
For sure. For sure. And really loved it. I mean, we worked our tail out. I did stats. I drove up to Cleveland, Ohio to develop film. We drove back. Jimmy Mack wanted stats on everything. And you were responsible for all those types of things. Plus, you had to get your master's degree. So I was taking classes. I mean, and thank God I was single, and I had all the time in the world. But it was some long, long days. Now, I ain't gonna lie.
Absolutely.
But it was good. It was good. I learned an absolute ton. If there was one thing like Jimmy Mack, he gave you organization and showed you really how to work and do it. Like he was fantastic with it. Like I could not ask for a better teacher. Because you talk about grinding. We grinded it, boy. Woo! He wasn't the greatest on his feet with the recruiting piece, but man, you talk about working and numbers and breaking down drills. He was a master at it. He was. He really was great.
What was something that, you know, irrespective of maybe the Kent experience specifically, but just going from the playing side of it to the coaching side of it, what was something that surprised you or something that maybe you didn't know going into it that you were like, man, I didn't realize that coaches spent so much time doing this? And obviously as a GA, you're getting stuck with a lot of the jobs and things that maybe other people nobody wants to do. But just think back to that time. What were some things that you were like, man, I didn't realize coaches spent all this time on this, even when you were watching Coach Mack?
We would meet on practice for hour and a half. And we would have to come up with drills. I mean, Roger Lyons and Sam Dixon, they had to come up with drills. And I'm like, wow. And Jimmy Mack would break it all down. And you were talking. Sometimes I'm better off just saying, okay, close out and keep the guy in front of you and keep it really simple. I mean, we broke it down to what foot, what pivot, how you swept the ball. I mean, detailed to the nth degree. You know, I think, you know, with good athletes, you got to give them some flexibility. For me, like, I'm not going to put them in a box. You know, I'm going to open it up and give them a concept and see if they can do it on their own. But Jimmy Mack, I mean, he wanted it done a certain way. You were going to pivot a certain way on the right foot. You're going to play a certain way. And we spent hours on practice preparation. That blew me away. And then statistically, we didn't really use the computer, so everything was a calculator. Right. And we every possession was charted. Jeff Gears would do the OER. We total it up. We had what the running total for the year was. We knew what the current during the halftime. We knew what plays worked. I mean, I detailed on everything like that, Mike. Like that would blew me away.
It's kind of amazing because I think back obviously to that time and I lived it for 4 years in terms of the statistics and the goal board and all those
goal
kinds
boards,
of things. And thinking about that and you kind of, you know, at the time you don't necessarily process this, especially on the player side of it, but you look back on it now and in a way it was way more forward thinking than you would necessarily give Coach McDonald for, because my initial thought whenever I think of Coach McDonald, my first thought is, he's an old school guy. I mean, that's just who he was. And yet that piece of it clearly was ahead of its time for sure.
I told him this probably 3 weeks ago. I don't think he was analytical before it was called analytical.
Yeah.
He was, very analytical. Like, he knew from the previous year playing Akron with Bob Huggins what plays worked against his defense. He would know exactly what he wanted to do and knew exactly how he wanted to guard Bob Huggins' plays. And I remember Huggins came in, I think, I don't know what year it was, but we had him down like 28-3 at Kent State. We had him down that bad. He had a hell of a team. And Jim, Matt, we drilled him by 35. And I remember Bob Huggins coming to the office, Jimmy Mack's office, almost crying. Like, he got absolutely drilled by this old school guy that knew how to coach it up. And yeah, was it programmed on how he did certain cuts and everything? Absolutely. But he was analytical on things before analyticals. I mean, I think you remember the conditioning drills where we go out to the football stadium and do tires and all that. And we charted all that stuff. Everything was charted. Everything had a stat to it. Everything was measured. And, you know, I say, whatever you want to get achieved, you got to measure. And everything got measured. And, you know, he was successful. You know, I mean, he used a lot of cliches, and he was always hard to get to know, but the guy could coach.
It's funny because I think back to, you know, thinking about the conditioning and you're doing the tires. And there's two things that stand out to me from that. One is the fact that, okay, you have that conditioning where now I could never imagine putting your players out on the blacktop and doing all that, you know, the pounding. You think, okay, even if you were doing that today, you would do it in a field house or do it on, you know, a track or on the AstroTurf or whatever, where you have less pounding on your legs. So that always still stands out to me when I think back about that. And then the other thing was, you talked about being measured. And there was always the 350 club. And now I don't remember how the reps broke out or whatever. But I remember I would kill myself every year to be able to get the stupid 350 club t-shirt that I still have sitting in my drawer in like this bag of, you know, shirts from my playing career, various different things that I kept that I'm sure would never even come close to fitting me at this point. But yeah, the 350 club for that. And it's just, you think back on those times and you're like, how ingenious was it that a stupid t-shirt motivated, well, at least it motivated me. I don't know if it motivated anybody else, but it motivated me.
I mean, that was plyometrics before plyometrics.
Right.
It was analyticals before it was analyticals. You start looking, there's some things that you'd obviously do different now, but you start going back, you know, the guy, he was smart with it. He was smart with it.
I think, no question.
You know, he's a little bit ahead of his time, but, you know, he was always a gruff guy, and we always laugh about it now. I mean, he was, you know, his wife was the sweetheart. He was the, you know, go to his house and he'd be in the basement working on numbers or something. It's funny now, but he's such a good guy. He's such a good person.
Yeah, I think that when I look back, and I said it to you a little bit before we jumped on, that when I look back on my time with Coach McDonald at Kent and just my own experience coming up and through high school and being recruited and the whole thing, and I was clearly a borderline Division I player where there wasn't a whole lot of people beating down my door to come have me play Division I basketball, and yet I thought that I could. I looked at guys that I played against in high school and saw some of the schools and places that they were going. I thought, I'm as good or better than those guys, and I just need to find the right place. And I think eventually I did. And Coach McDonald was a guy that, again, was he tough? Was he hard-nosed? Was he very stringent the way you just described, where things had to be done a certain way? I remember my freshman year being thinking about having to close out and having to have my right foot up on you know, on this side of the basket and my left foot up on the other side of the basket. And if you didn't do that, practice was stopped, and you know, you knew you were gonna hear it from them. And yet, because of the type of player that I was from a coachability standpoint, and just I was a guy who I felt like you could keep throwing things at me, and I was gonna keep trying to push my way through that and do whatever it was to be able to please my coach. And so I think that that ended up being a perfect scenario for me to be able to have success. And eventually I was able to do that. And so I'm forever grateful to Coach McDonald for the opportunity that he gave me, and for guys like yourself and Coach Grube and the other people that were part of the staff that were instrumental in the success that I was eventually able to have.
Mike, you brought the intangible. I mean, you were one of those guys that Jim McDonald would see that a normal young assistant right now would not see. That he saw intangible things that you did to win games and how that fit in the way he wanted to coach. I think that's sometimes we as coaches just try to allot a bunch of talent and then figure it out.
Right.
He had it figured out and was looking for the right guys. I think that's what made it unique, because he would win and people would look at his team and go, God, how in the hell is Eric Glenn scoring 16 right. a game? He's yeah. pudgy. He's right. overweight. What the heck? Like, and we would win games. I mean, when I was there, I think we went to 2 or 3 NITs and we competed for the MAC championship a couple times. And I'm like, and if you looked at our town, sometimes looking at the other town, you're going, how in the hell are we doing it? Like, how are we doing this? You know, but if we played a certain way, we didn't beat ourselves. And, you know, he had some mental toughness with you guys. And that's what you were good at, Mike. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and I'm not trying to blow smoke and, you know, but that's where you were tough. I mean, you did those little things that made that win games. And sometimes I think when you go out recruiting, you're looking for the guy who touches the top of the backboard or the guy who can hit a 35-foot fadeaway three. But this other guy who's, you know, can score, you know, I use a great example for me. I tell everybody, I mean, I had a lottery pick in Chris Kamen that we had to beat 2 Division III schools for. Nobody was recruiting a kid. You know, when I was at Central Michigan, we beat Hope and Calvin. That was the only schools recruiting them.
Yeah.
You know, and finding those diamonds in the rough that can actually, at the MAC level, can really have a great career. And I thought that's what happened with you, Mike. I think, you know, you had a great career. You went to the right place. I'm going to say that. You went for the right coach. You're right on with what you're saying.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that my career could have gone a lot of different ways. It would have been very easy for me to end up somewhere else and just be with a coach who didn't appreciate the things that I did, which, as you described, I think were probably, again, not that I didn't contribute on the floor because I did, but just in terms of those intangible things, it takes a certain type of coach that will overlook the fact that I wasn't the fastest guy. I wasn't the highest jumper out there. I didn't look physically imposing, and not everybody will look past that, as you said. And I think that Coach McDonald, to his credit and to my benefit, was able to do that. And as a result, I got a chance to have an outstanding experience for 4 years. And I tell people all the time, I wouldn't trade what I went through and what we accomplished and what I was able to do in my career. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And it goes back to what you said when you were talking about your high school career and just growing up in the game. And the one thing that for me I always come back to is I just love to play. And that's what I wanted to do. And I was going to do whatever it took to be able to do that. And by playing in terms of my career at Kent, it was figuring out what role am I going to have to play in order to be able to get on the floor. And that's what I tried to do, is figure out how can I make people happy? How can I make the coaching staff happy? How can I make Coach McDonald happy? What can I do to help our team? And that's going to enable me to get on the floor. And it's just because, again, I love to play. The day the season was over, I just went and played pickup basketball because I just love to play. And
that's a little bit of the difference with today's. I think a lot of, I'm going to say this and probably upset some people, I think some kids love to score but like to win. You know, they like to, they love to score and just like to play. Like,
right.
It's the love and passion for the game, what the game can do for you to help you propel you in your life. I mean, it's opened so many doors for me. It's opened doors for you. No matter what you say, it's really helped. You didn't have basketball, man. I can't imagine going to high school without basketball in my life.
Right. I agree. I agree 100% on that. Let me ask you this. I'm just curious, your perspective from your different experiences at the Division I level, and you think about how we talked a little bit before we jumped on, just about how the virus has cut down the amount of time that you have to work with your players. And so they're kind of having to figure out their own workouts. They don't have somebody there working them out. And what I look at when I'm thinking about the Division I scenario today, and you have guys who are on campus basically 11 months out of the year, and they're with the coaching staff and they're working out, and they're either at practice or in the summer they have their individual workouts, then you've got the season and all this stuff. And I think back to my own experiences, and, you know, our season ended and I remember being handed a weight workout, say, hey, make sure you do this before we see you again next fall. And part of that for me was good, because what I wanted to do when the season was over was I wanted to go back and just play, and I wanted to work on my game and get better. And I kind of, you know, put together my own plan. And for me, I feel like at the level of intensity that requires in order to be successful at that level, 11 months out of the year seems like a huge grind, both for the players and the coaches, in terms of, I would just think that they'd start to get sick of each other to a certain degree, and that you'd never like relight the fire of, man, I've been away for a little bit, I can't wait to get back because I never go away, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, like I think it's been good. We've only had three guys in town through this whole pandemic. One was getting rehab. Isaiah Livers getting rehab. So he's getting, you know, he needed to see the trainer and get his hips right. And he put in for the draft. And, you know, he's trying to get his body right. He can't do that back in Kalamazoo. So that's okay. And then Adrian Nunez, who is over in Brooklyn where it was real bad, his parents didn't want him to come back. in a good way. Not
right, I understand.
You know, so he had to stay there rooming up. And then Eli Brooks is in Philly. And they had the same thing. His parents would like for him to stay here. So those three stayed in town. And, you know, they found places to play like most. And then I'm going to say this too. Like, back when we were in school, including you and Mike, I think we played a lot. Like, we played more than the kids play today. Like, we just played. I mean, we just shirts, skins. You played. Like, you played. We played one-on-one. Shoot, we played one-on-one for hours. You don't get that. Like, I do think players shoot the ball better. They're stronger. They're faster. All those things. But I'm not sure, like, they played like we played. I mean, now because you've got, obviously, strength and conditioning coaches. And you've got workout guys. And they're all – I'm not bad-mouthing any of them. All of them fit into the puzzle of being a really good player. I think there's a time and a place. And how you manage those things, I think, are really important. But you still have to play the game. It's still about decision-making. It's about your habits, how you play. Because I can't tell you how many times I hear a coach say, well, man, he just doesn't know how to play. Well, let's teach him. Like, we have to teach him how to play. Like, but he can dribble through eight cones and he can, you know, do a 360 and he can do all that. But you have to learn how to play. And, you know, playing 3-on-3, playing 2-on-2, playing 1-on-1. I think those things helped us. I don't know how you feel, but I've always felt like, it helped me understand how to play. Like, you couldn't hide in 3-on-3. You were going to get exposed or be exposed. Like, you expose them or be exposed. That's the way it was. And you fought to win games. Now, as you said, you know, you play a lot of games, and kids these days don't, you know, they keep playing. And I'm getting off track of your question, though. Sorry about the training and that. But it's like, our guys have to understand, like, with this growth and development right now, that we're not going to have individual workouts like we once did. The new norm is going to be you getting in the gym and getting up shots and being creative. Use your imagination, you know, figure out how it works. Look at a couple of YouTube videos, and it's not hard. Like, this isn't, you know, you're not going to chemistry class. This is supposed to be fun, enjoyable, you know, a time in your life where you really can develop and use your creativity, and you just think outside the box, and there's no wrong answer. It's all good. But, you know, you have to find time to reload, recharge 100%. But for me, and probably you, Mike, it was a few weeks, and I was back playing again. Like, let's go hoop. Like,
right. Mine was the next day. I mean, I remember season ending and being in the annex playing literally the day after season ended. Because, again, it was a totally different way of playing, especially we've talked about it now for the last 20 minutes. Playing for Coach McDonald was a very structured environment. There was a way that you played, and clearly very, very different from how you would play in a playground game, in a pickup game. And so I always, again, just like you, I grew up playing pickup basketball. That's what I drive over all over the city to find games and play. And from the time I was 13 or 14 years old, playing with older guys, and that's how I felt like I got better. And to your point that you were talking about in terms of thinking about skills trainers and strength and conditioning, and just, I think the skill level of today's players is much, much higher than it was during the era when you played or when I played.
Without question.
Players can shoot the ball so much better. There's kids who handle the ball ways that I could have only dreamed of. And yet, I think the difference is, and I think you kind of hinted at it, was basketball is a decision-making sport. And what I see where kids aren't as good is the basketball IQ side of it, where yeah, you have all these skills, but I'm not sure that you really know how to apply those. Because again, as you said, they don't play as much. They don't play in a free form environment. All their playing is done with a coach on the sideline, with mom and dad in the stands, with a coach telling you what to do, or at least stand on the sideline pretending to tell you what to do in some cases. And you're not just out there playing going, okay, I'm better than everybody in this game. I think I'm going to just work on my left hand, or this is a game where everybody's really good, and so I got to make sure I go and defend the best player on the other team, or, you know, this is a really highly competitive situation. We just got to do whatever it takes to win, or else I'm going to have to sit for an hour and a half and lose this game. And those things are things that the game teaches you just by going out and playing pickup basketball. I don't think you learn those things playing AAU basketball or even high school basketball, to be honest with you.
I'm going to agree with you. Like, I think it's important. Like, to me, I heard a guy talk about this, and I totally agree with this. Like, playing a small-sided game of three-on-three where you find out what your basketball IQ is about. You get in an open floor where you're playing five-on-five and the floor is wide open. It's just about athleticism then. But if you get in a small-sided game where it's, okay, we're going to use half this court and we're going to play three-on-three, now you're going to find out about IQ. And now you're going to find out, can a guy play without the ball? What can he do? And I think those are the things we as coaches, if you want to find out if a guy can play, put him in a three-on-three, cut the court in half and say, okay, we're going to play three-on-three. And does he just stand there? Can he screen? Can he cut? Can he back screen somebody? Can he replace himself? I mean, all the things you have to learn how to do. Like, I feel like I could take you out right now, Mike, me, you, and three guys, and just move the ball around and never have played together in 20 years and could still play. And still could play.
Yep. So
just
true.
Because you kind of know how to play and how to move, where today's kids, because we're so programmed, we're getting so programmed into drills and, you know, okay, work me out, and that's all I do, and I can shoot it, but I don't know how to play. I can't tell you how many guys I've seen that they don't know what to do. Like, just stand. They don't. What do I do? Like, what do I? You have to teach them how to play. A big part of my camps, and because I was successful, we tried to teach kids, okay, there's one ball, there's five dudes out here, okay? We have to teach you something to do rather than stand there, all right? And, yep. And really, for little kids, if you could just get them to pass and cut, you're way ahead of the game. You're way ahead of the game. Like, if you can just pass, cut, move the ball side to side, you've already you're ahead. You're 80% ahead of everybody else, you know, because we as parents – thank God I'm not one of them. My kid knows how to motion offense. I've been sure of that. But it's like we structure everything. We gather the friends up. We get them in the van. We drive them over to play. We pick the teams for them. If you told our guys right now, hey, go play shirts and skins, you guys pick the teams, they would spend 45 minutes trying to figure out what the hell it is.
Absolutely. I've said to the people, so when I started camp this summer, if I get to do any camps, but this would be 28 years of me running camp. And for the first, I'd say 15 years, we'd go shirts and skins, and kids would literally kill each other to be skins. Cause a lot of times we were in a hot gym that wasn't air conditioned.
Yeah.
And so you'd tell the kids, all right, you're at basket number two and you're with coach whoever. And they'd be sprinting there to see which team could rip off their shirts fast enough to be skins. And then about 15 years in, it completely flipped where I would say, okay, your team is skins. And these kids would look at me. I'm talking like 8, 9 years old. They look at me and be like, I'm not taking off my shirt. And I would say, what do you mean? What do you mean? I don't even understand what do you mean you won't take off your shirt? And eventually I just gave up. Like, I just gave up because you couldn't get them to move.
With
it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's some of the things that, you know, maybe are wrong with them. I mean, it helped us. I know there'll be solutions down the road that we'll figure out. But when you reflect back on it, to me, it's like it's still basketball. We still have to have fun with the game. There's different ways to skin this. You know, you have to be positive with kids. I know I've changed my coaching techniques. You probably have too, Mike. You just can't go after people like that. Some kids like it. Some kids love being, you know, get after me, and they like that part of it. But you know, all that stuff has changed. It has. It's changed the coaching circle for sure.
Yeah, there's no doubt that if you think about the way that the majority of coaches would have interacted with players back in the time when you were playing or when I was playing, it was far more of, look, you're going to do it this way because this is the way I say you're going to do it. And I think it was, I don't want to say it was more difficult, but I just think that there was more of a divide between the players are over here, the coaches are over here. And yeah, there was relationships being built. But at the same time, I feel like today we've sort of swung the other direction where the relationship piece of it has become so critical to being able to put together your team. And I think rightfully so. I think if you look at why you get into coaching and what it's about making a positive impact on the young people that are put in front of you and using the game of basketball to be able to do that. So being able to build relationships with your players, to me, is one of the most satisfying things that you can do as a coach. And like you know, there's no better feeling than getting a phone call 10 years out from somebody who played with you, played for you, and just saying, hey, coach, this is going on, or hey, coach, I got a question, or hey, coach, I just wanted to talk. There's nothing better than that. And it is interesting the way that the coaching pendulum has changed and the way we've sort of redefined what a coach is.
No question. I mean, that's, you said it eloquently. It's fun to look back, though, like we are right now, and how we skinned it differently. You know, there's a lot of ways to go about it without a question. There's you know, pick and choose, but having a positive impact on somebody, whatever level it might be. I ran camps, oh, God, Mike, for 30 years. This is the first year that really I've been involved in camps in probably, this is my 35th year, so like 34 years. I did them last year at Michigan here with Juwan, and I loved it. Like, I got right into teaching again. I was like, I took the little kids, all right? I took the young bucks.
All right, are you still, I got to ask you a question. So the summer, I'm pretty sure it was probably the summer after you left Kent and went to Michigan, which we'll talk about here in a second, that you gave me the opportunity to come up and work camp. It might have even been after my sophomore year. I can't remember, but came up and work camp. Are you guys still doing the triple threat on the whistle and singing hail to the victors? Are you guys still doing that?
Oh, gosh. We didn't know. Chris Hunter kind of, I help him. Because I came in July, so I didn't have a lot of time to do a lot. But they did that after I left for a while. And then obviously Beeline took over and had his own spin on it. But I have carried that with me almost all the camps through Central Michigan. We had 2,200 kids a summer up at Central coming through. Really enjoyed doing them. Like, it wasn't, anybody's like, it's the money. But the money, what really wasn't my camp. It was the school's camp. I enjoyed, because I can't tell you now how many guys come and go. And they're looking older. I mean, they're 30s, 40s. Like, hey, coach, you had me at camp back at Michigan or Central. I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is my son. You know, he's going to come to Michigan camp next year. Like, oh, my gosh. But I enjoyed, the thing about it was I really enjoyed teaching. Like, I took 125 kids last year at Michigan's camp here. And I had the young group. Like, I really enjoyed breaking it down and teaching. Now the games get ragtag, yeah, but it's having fun with them and trying to improve their game. And it's cool at the end of it, though, Mike, when they come up and want to get a picture with you and they want you to autograph their T-shirt still. And it's like, okay, I haven't lost touch with the youth. I'm right. Still good. I'm relevant. I'm still relevant.
No All doubt right? about that. The camp, you know? The camp atmosphere is great, and I stole that idea minus the hail to the victors. I stole the whistle and the triple threat from you way back when, and then I've carried that tradition on at my camp. It's been tremendously successful and fun. And
you know what, Mike? That's something that we just kind of stumbled into, and it got everybody's attention.
Yeah, it works.
I can't tell you. Everybody had stolen. Everybody's like, well, I learned it from Jay. I think I learned it from Don Meyer.
Probably.
My favorite part of the whole thing is I get to be the in charge of the push-up club for kids that aren't
kids that don't get a triple threat. Then so, Jason so comes I'm, in so as the
I'm
bad the, guy.
I'm the, I don't know, I'm the enforcer. I make triple threat position push-ups if they're not doing what they're supposed to do.
So. That's awesome. That, you know what? They lead, one thing they'll know. They'll know what passion, what triple threat means. If they learn anything else, they'll know what one thing is. That's triple threat.
That's for sure. No doubt about that. All right. So let's talk about leaving Kent and getting an opportunity to go to Michigan. And obviously while you're there, you get an opportunity to work with the Fab Five. So let's just talk a little bit about that whole experience. And first of all, how you left Kent, got to Michigan, and then just tell us a little bit about your experience there.
Well, before even I worked at Kent, I was working basketball camp at Michigan when my sister was there. So I'd stay with my sister. She played there. And I'd work camp for Frieder, and I'd come in, and, you know, we'd work. That's back when you worked 6 days a week, and he'd pay you $100. And we were working from, like, 7:30 in the morning till 8 at night, and he'd pay you $100. You're like, are you kidding me? I mean, he's making hand over foot cash, and we're picking up the scraps, which it's funny now. I laugh about it because he was out in the parking lot hawking T-shirts and selling them. Anyway, so I stayed in touch with Fisher, and then when Fisher got the job, I had reached out. I know I reached out to him, and, you know, because they always say, hey, if you work camps, you know your relationship. And I always tried to, at basketball camp, what I tried to do was really build relationships, and I tried to zero in on a few camps. Like, I didn't work a bunch of the circuit. I'd zero in. Like, I would work 3 weeks at Michigan, no question about it. I'm going back there, and I got pretty close with Steve Fisher, and that kind of propelled it. And then when it opened up, I was at Kent's, obviously, at the time. I had called, and, you know, Fisher said, why don't you come up? I want to talk to you. So I went up, and we talked. And I remember going into the interview, Mike, I'll never forget this, is my wife. I said, hey, if Fisher offers me the job, I'm taking it. I'm not going to sit here and go, well, let me talk to my wife. I want to let her right now. If he offers it, honey, I'm taking it. And sure enough, he offered it to me. And I took it up. I was like, hey, I'm in 100 right now. And I want to play one thing back, Mike, because it reminds me of you. Jim McDonald taught me a great thing in recruiting. He made a great point. He goes, you got, when they say they want to come and be part of it, those are the kids you want. And you wanted to be part of it. Once you figured it out, you were like, hey, I want to come to Kent State. Jim loved that. Like, Jim loved guys that would come out and say, hey, I want to come play for you. And I think kids miss the boat on that a little bit. And it's the same thing when Steve Fisher says, you know, most guys will say, well, let me talk to my wife, or can I get back with you at the end of the day or tomorrow? And I shook his hand like, I'm in. Right now, I'm in. And I think that leaves a lasting impression. I think you did the same thing with Jim McDonald. I mean, you wanted to come. Jim want to be part of it. You want to find kids that want to be part of it. You want to find coaches that want to be part of it. And it's not. And I knew enough about Michigan, so I wasn't overthrown. I just wanted to be there. Ann Arbor was exciting. I believe in Steve Fisher. Steve to this day is, there's not a better person, coach, around. I know it's hard to, I mean, he is fantastic. Like, he, I'll give you a quick story. So I had left there, Jason and Mike, I'd left there, and I took the job at Central. And I was at Central for a year, and my wife was pregnant with our first child. So I stopped in Ann Arbor at my sister's because I was on a recruiting trip. I was flying down to Georgia. And my wife came down and brought me clothes. And she was pregnant with Cooper at the time. And all of a sudden, we go out to eat. And I'm getting ready to fly out the next day. My wife goes into labor. And we go to the hospital. We have the baby. The first person up there is Steve Fisher's wife, Angie. And, like, that's how – even though I've been gone a year – the first, beat my mom, beat all the parents. The first person there was Angie with flowers and stuff for my wife. That's the kind of relationship and person he is. I mean, that's the kind of family atmosphere you want to be part of. That is family. That was and will always be family. And Steve and Angie are terrific. Brian Dutcher was there with us, with me. I was with him, I should say. But I was fortunate to get hired and again, jumped into the saddle. The first thing we had to do, I think I got there in the spring, is, you know, Dutcher moved over to full-time assistant at the time, and I took over the camps, and I had about 3 weeks to get ready for 2,000 kids coming in. I had no idea what I was doing, and my head was spinning at the time, and I'm trying to figure out players' names. And a real quick story is I'll never forget this. It was 89, right after they won it, we came in and I was getting things set up for camp. And I'm over in the old intramural building and I'm opening doors at 7 o'clock in the morning, 6:45, making sure everything's set. And, you know, if you don't, Fisher's going to be screaming at me. So I'm making sure balls are out. I go to the intramural building and hit this ball bouncing. And I'm like, what the hell? It's 7 in the morning. There ain't nobody out here, man. Coaches are recovering from going to the bar the night before. I'm like, who in the hell is in here? So I look at it, and here's Ramil Robinson in the gym just working on ball handling with a dim light. Didn't have the lights on in there. And he's just doing ball handling by himself, working out. And I'm like, wow. So the day goes through in the afternoon, and I come back to the intramural building. It's probably around 11:45. He's out on the track with a weighted vest doing wind sprints in the heat of the summer. I'm like, holy crap. And you understood now what it was about. Like at Michigan, I mean, at Kent, you're limited with some of the things that you have. At Michigan, they obviously have a little bit more, like Ohio State and, you know, Indiana. But it was the intensity of his workout that I was blown away with. Like, I was blown away. Not that we didn't work hard at Kent State now, but it was just, it was just weird seeing him there doing it.
Right.
Like, nobody around, no. And this was right after they won the national title. Like, this was, you know, right after they won 89 title, he's doing all this. You're going, wow, you're talking commitment. And that was at a high level. That was the first time it kind of woke my eyes up to the whole Michigan in training procedures that was going on. It was huge.
Yeah, I think that when you start talking about guys that have the kind of success that he obviously had, you're talking about guys who have a tremendous amount of physical talent, and then they go about maximizing that physical talent that they have. And that's when you start looking at guys who are NBA players, guys who are all Americans.
Elite.
There's things that set them apart that other players can only dream of. Even if you have the same work ethic as Ramil Robinson, you may not have the physical tools that he has in order to be able to have the success. And I think that's when you start talking about the difference, and we can get into this maybe a little bit too, when you start talking about the difference in the levels of college basketball, it's not necessarily that any player at the Division III level doesn't have comparable skills to some Division I players. It's just your Division III point guard might be 5'10", and your Division I high-level point guard is 6'5". And there's a huge difference in that, and it doesn't necessarily come down to who's more skilled. It comes down to, again, do you have the physical tools? And then we all know, no matter what you do, if you have physical tools, you still have to put the work in if you're going to have success. And too often, I'm sure you've seen it over the course of your career, guys that have tremendous physical tools and yet just don't take advantage of them the way you as a coach, I'm sure, would like to see.
There's no question. That's very well said, very well put. There's a lot of, I mean, you can take Duncan Robinson, who came from, Hamilton? Was that what it was? Out in Division III, ended up coming to Michigan, and now he's in the NBA making, you know, millions of dollars. So it's possible. It takes a great deal of work. I think some of it's genetics. It's just the way it is. I mean,
right.
Guys are 7'1". I mean, it's just the way it is. Doesn't mean a Division II or Division III player can't be. It takes a tremendous amount of work. I'm often interested when guys talk, though, like, hey, I worked my tail off, and, you know, and okay, what'd you do today? Well, I shot for an hour, and that's it. Like, matching work habits against the elite, I mean, when you think you've done something, you need to do some more. I mean, that's just what it is. Like, Xavier Simpson's a great illustration for us. I mean, Juwan had to tell him to get out of the gym. Like, you're overtraining. Like, you're burning. He's there in the summer at 6 a.m. I work out every day in the morning at 6. So he's in there shooting, like, with two managers, like, ruthlessly shooting and coming back and lifting and then playing and coming back in the evening for more shots. Like, at one point, you know, diminishing return, and less is more. But, I mean, those types of work ethics are, because I always tell, you know, successful guys will tell you how they, just watch them. They'll show you how they're doing it. They'll tell you. Like, it's simple. Like, it's not complicated. Like, they'll show you exactly what they're doing. But some guys, unfortunately, have other things on their mind. Like, they just, you know, they think they're going to get to the NBA just on talent. And it's like anything else. I mean, when you match up talent against talent, you know, now it's about technique, it's decision making, it's mental preparation, all those things that can separate you from the next guy. Because when you're going five star against five star, what is it? Like, there's going to be some technique, some decision making, your habits. I mean, are you in great shape? Are you staying? Are you getting rest? Are you sleeping? Is it nutrition? I think a big part of the game today that's missing, and I'm a big believer of this, Mike, is, you know, we didn't have, it was just mental preparation, meditation. I think it's a huge part of the game that a lot of coaches, when you say that, are like, oh, that's just a bunch of, you know, hogwash. You know, you want toughness, you want mental toughness. I mean, you got to work it between the ears. You got to be able to play present. You can't play in the past. I can't tell you how many guys I've seen that will miss a shot and live in the past. Like, they'll look at the coach. They can't make the next four or five shots, you know? Or there's some players are just so athletically given, but they're scatterbrained. They don't know, they can't slow their thought process down enough to play with a high level of IQ, but have all the athletic ability in the absolute world, but still need to train mentally how to play and how to play present and how to like control the controllables and let everything else go.
So how do you work with players on that? Like, what are you guys doing right now? What does Juwan do with the players there? What did you do maybe while you were a head coach to help players to be able to develop those skills? Because obviously, just like the physical skills, those skills have to be worked on. You have to practice them if you're going to be able to do them in a game situation. So what do you guys do to be able to help your kids do those things?
That's a great question. You know, I really did not get involved mentally until I got around Juwan. Like, I've read stuff, but all of a sudden, I had about four webinars, and I've been reading, and then we had a guy, Rush Ross. He has Vision Pursuit. It's an app, and we did a clinic on it with him because Juwan did it with the Heat. He really believes in it. This guy does the Heat. He does the Atlanta Falcons. What else? He has a couple more teams, Alabama. Really good, Mike. Just on, like I said, he talks about embrace the negative, like embrace it, but then allow yourself to process it and now let it go. Learn to train your mind to let it go. Like, okay, you screwed up. Yeah, let it go. You got to separate yourself from it and play present. And it's okay. Like, you screwed up. That's okay. It's normal. And he does some meditation things with his app and that are really helpful. I never meditated, honestly, God. I started doing it last summer. Shoot, you talk about getting relaxed and fall. I fell asleep. Hell, I'm like, I'm old school with it. I'm like, wow.
That's what I do whenever I try it. My wife and I have been with our kids for a little while, and my kids would always start yelling at me, Dad, you're asleep again. You're asleep. But can I
say this, Mike? It's something, though, like if you just took, you know, 10 minutes of your practice, 10 minutes every day, just 10 minutes, that's it. And worked on those things. Like, I think Phil Jackson was ahead of his time. Because if you watch The Last Dance, the players talked about when they won the title, well, we did Zen and we did meditation. That helped us. And, you know, they credit some of that to Phil Jackson. And like I said, people will leave clues if you just listen to it and pay attention. Like, they will tell you how they're doing it. And, you know, now you got LeBron James and the Calm app that he has out there. They're running. I think all those things, because I do think it comes a point where everybody's got the X's and O's. Now it's, you know, how many times do you say a kid, well, he's mentally challenged, or he's not mentally tough enough, or he can't do it. He can't. Like, then we have to help him. Like, we have to figure out that missing piece that bridges that gap between performance and the mental preparation. And find that gap and close the gap. And you could close it. I'm a believer in it. 100% behind it. I am. And I'm not. And again, here's an old guy, 59, who used to say, hey, suck it up. Get through it. Bite the bullet. You're tough enough. Get through it. And more, I'm more compassionate to it and understand it now, saying, okay, is there a different way we can do this?
Yeah, I think that's a great point you made in terms of the change in the mindset of a coach in that. Yep. You're thinking about before it was like, okay, we're asking you to do this. And if you as the player can't do it, then I think the conversation amongst coaches, and I've been involved in these conversations as a coach, what's wrong with player X, this guy? Why can't he do the things that we're asking him to do? What's his problem? And I think now it's shifted the other direction where when you can't get a kid to do something, I'm guessing that the conversation within the coach's office is, okay, we're asking him to do this, but he can't get it for some reason. Now we brainstorm and try to figure out how can we help him to be able to do it instead of just grumbling about it.
No question. And the other thing is now you're talking about, you know, the millennials, right? And now you're talking about kids that have been through the economic crisis. They've been through social media. They've had, you know, they've been through a plethora of 9/11. They've been through, you know, and they got cell phones and social media and all those types of things that, to me, weigh in on the millennials. And you have to understand what they are. Like, we have to understand what they've gone through. We didn't think about us. Like, we didn't have this stuff. The social media anymore, I mean, people can be brutal. can be social media bullies. Like there's a lot on their plate. And you say, well, they just got to tune it out. Well, that's like putting an alcoholic behind a bar and tell them to serve alcohol, but don't drink anything. All right. That's not going to happen. I mean, kids are going to go into it and understand and look at it. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot on their plate. There is. There's a ton on their plate now. You know, you got boyfriends, girlfriends. And this is to me, these kids are more educated because of the internet than we ever were. I mean, we just didn't have what these kids have today. And I just think that changes the dynamics. You better understand millennials if you're going to be coaching them. And I think a lot of it has to do with their mental state. I think millennials are a needy group.
How do you help the kids deal with social media from a standpoint of, I'm sure at the University of Michigan that a game ends, a player has a bad game, and I'm sure that their Twitter is blowing up with people criticizing them and saying, oh, this, you know, what a terrible game you had, and I'm sure things much worse than that. So how do you help kids to navigate that piece of it, which is clearly something that early in your career as a coach, you never had to deal with. Certainly, you never dealt with it as a player. So I'm just curious what you do with guys who are at a high level like you guys are. What do you do? How do you help them?
Well, you know what? It's funny you say. I just listened to Doc Rivers today talk about it. With Steve Kerr. And I was listening to him talk how at halftime.
Yeah, I heard him say that today. I only got like 10 minutes of that episode. But
They go to their phones. And he goes, it's like the problem device because – as soon as they pick it up, it's a problem. Like you're not getting enough shots, or it's your agent talking about you need. You know, he's screwing you over. It's never positive, and you know, social media is one of those things. But you wish the kids would say, okay, I'm just going to tune it out. I'm not going to get involved. But as soon as you start tweeting and putting things out there, now you're in the mix with it. And like anything else, I think there's a time and a place for it. Mike, I think we do a good job of trying to educate them, but I think every guy has his own routine with it. I'm not going to lie. Like they're going to listen to it, but you're talking about 20-year-old with an education, with a device that he can touch thousands of people with, are going to listen to everything you say. They're going to test the waters. And I think education is the best policy with it. Like we try to educate as much as we can. And I heard Doc Rivers say another point that I'm going to bring back to our guys. Let the subject be the subject. You don't need to be the subject. Let whatever you're preaching be the subject, but you don't need to be the subject. And I thought that's a great point. Like, if you know, if it's the Black Lives Movement, just make sure the Black Lives Movement is the subject and not you on a personal tirade, you know, challenging people out there that is only going to end in disaster for you. It is. I mean, the social media, there's always going to be those people that are going to be distractors and doubters, and they're always the critics. You know, are going to be there. They always are. They're looking for the Critic of the Year award to hand out to somebody, but they're always going to be out there throwing, you know, jabs at you. You just, like we try to do with our guys, stay positive. Don't go in the gutter, because when you get in the gutter, you both get dirty.
Absolutely.
And you got to try to stay above the line. And you know, I think the social media can be a great thing. I think, you know, some of the things you're putting out with Black Lives Matter and COVID-19 stuff, I think is terrific. It is. And some of it's harsh, you know, and that's it's never going to be positive. Social media is going to have its critics. Like I said, it's always going to be there. But we try to do a great job of educating. Juwan talks all the time about it. We try to send out nothing but positive. And then, you know, it's the one-on-one relationships you have with your players. I was just on a text with somebody a few minutes ago about they wanted to kind of run home for Father's Day. And we're all about family here. And I said, hey, Juwan's not going to care. It's about family. If you're going home just to hang out, but it's family. And we have that transparency in our program, which really makes it really, really cool. And that's the way Juwan is with it. Very transparent, very open with things. But, you know, that's what we try to do. We just try to do a great job of educating. In the end, they got to make that choice. You know, and hopefully they take, you know, try to take our advice. And I think we do a good job of providing examples. And obviously we try to live the example too.
All right. Give me the best Fab Five story you can come up with.
We don't have enough time.
Just give me one. Give me one good one that people would enjoy hearing. And then we'll talk about your time at Central.
Okay. Real quick. I mean, this is kind of a stale one, but it's kind of cool. We, I'll never forget when we would go to an arena. I'm going to use Wisconsin, for example, in the old Camp Randall Fieldhouse. We would go, and when we had the Fab Five, it was like traveling. I tell people it's like traveling with the Beatles. I say it all the time. It's unbelievable what we did. But we'd go to Wisconsin, and their locker rooms across the corridor. For the old folks that are listening, anybody's out there, you got to go across the lobby. Well, they had gated area that we could get through, and we had gates getting to the bus. But it was just funny because we would go out, and our guys would come on the floor and we'd warm up. All right. And there would be 20 deep all the way around our half court. And you look at the other end, and Wisconsin's warming up, and there's nobody down at that end watching. it was just those things were just like I would sit back and I mean it just they were cute stories. I mean it was just funny. Like we went to Penn State, and I think you probably seen clips of it when Ray Jackson I think threw it off the window of old alumni gym that's no longer there. I don't think if it is, it's renovated. And Chris Webber dunked it, threw it down, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're gonna start booing. The whole side got on their knees and started bowing to our guys. I mean, things like that where you're sitting there going, they just had a good time with it. And our guys kind of, they were the trailblazers with it. I hate to say it, but they wore the baggy socks. They had fun. They were vocal. They weren't, and Steve let them be that way. And I'll be honest with you, Dick Vitale, those guys didn't like us. They didn't like us. Now kids, they wore the baggy socks or baggy shorts and black socks. It's okay. Like, they were trailblazers. And it was cool because our guys, the dude hired me back. Tawan hires me back. Like, that's the kind of relationship. I mean, I coached his son. I mean, we stayed in touch. Jimmy's in town. I see Jalen came up during the Rutgers game at Rutgers and gave me a bear hug during the game. in typical Jalen fashion, and Juwan's special. And, I coached Chris Weber's two other brothers at Central, David and Jason. And, I haven't talked to Chris in a while. That's the one that's kind of missing for me. And, if I ever get the chance, obviously I love to be able to reconnect with him. And I know he has some issues with it, but, we have to learn to forgive as people. I think that's the big thing. And if we ever get a chance to chat, I think we can bring some closure to some things.
It's when I think back to that team, and obviously it's the same era that I was playing, but just thinking about it more from a fan perspective, it's just that was the first team. I think you hit it really well when you said that they just had fun with it. And I think that was something that you could sense. It was just a different sort of feel around that team. It really was. It seemed like they were always like they were just having fun. It was five friends doing what you and I were doing when we were in high school, playing together and being buddies and just having a good time with it. And then, as you said, setting the trends, the long shorts and the short socks and the black socks, and just they were different from anything that was out there at the time.
It was cool. It's okay. Like people, you talk about Black Lives Matter. We had letters and people, saying really rude things to our guys. But you know what? It didn't defray from us having fun. Like, we had fun. I know some of the older crowd didn't like it, but that's okay. Like, they expressed themselves. I know there were some things I think Fish would curtail a little bit. But at the time, it was new for us too.
Right.
We were kind of going through it for the first time, five freshmen starting. I mean, that was unheard of back then. I just think, we all learned a lot. I think if we go back, I'm not sure we change a ton of things. We might tweak a few things, but it was such a fascinating time. The guys have done such a great job. Ray Jack came in this. I haven't seen Ray Jack in 20 years. He came in this year for a game. We hung out. It was like they never left. Like the words to describe it is, and they say it all the time, is love. Like hey, I love you, man. Like it's unbelievable. Like it's all the guys. It's Juwan. I love you, man. Like it's always like that. And it's people are jealous about it. Like some people are like, man, you got what we want. Like right. That's the way we want to be. Yep. And it is. I mean, if any of them, and like I say this too, it wasn't just them. I mean, Rob Pelinka was Chris Kamen's agent. We stayed in touch. Michael Talley stayed in touch. Eric Riley, Mike Talley, Rob, James Vosko, all those guys. I mean, they were Freddie Hunter, all the guys around that team. It wasn't just them, but it was, I mean, obviously they played a huge, huge part in it. But even the guys coming up, Jason Bossert, I saw him this summer. He'd be back in a long time, and we touched base. Like, it was very cool. Very cool to see everybody.
Absolutely. I think that when you start talking about, just as we said earlier, those relationships and the fact that you're tied in with guys who are going to go down, they're always going to be part of the history of basketball. Without question, that team will 100 years from now will be remembered. And there aren't very many teams that didn't win a national title that will be remembered as fondly as that team is going to be remembered as we continue to go forward, because they were just, it was so unique in the moment, and it continues to be unique when you look back at it.
No doubt. No, you're exactly right. No, it's trend setting. Whatever you wanted to say, they will go in history books, even though we didn't win a title. We came close, but man, it was such a ride. It was so much fun. I look back, I just, it was so much fun. And leaving Kent State, I thought, oh, what did I get myself into? You know, you didn't know what you were getting into, but it just turned out fantastic. And all the credit to the players, to our coaching staffs that we had there, Mike Boyd, Brian Dutcher, Perry Watt, all of them. I mean, just, it was just fantastic. I've just, like I said before, this thing, man, I've been blessed. I've been blessed in a lot of ways.
All right, let's talk about then the opportunity to become a head coach and transition from being an assistant. Just talk about what that transition was like, what you learned over the course of your time of being a head coach at Central.
Wow. Well, when I left Michigan, I went to Grand Valley for a year. We ended up being 24-6. We won the GLIAC, got to the NCAA Division II tournament, broke attendance records, had a first-team All-American on the team. I brought in 4 D1 transfer and 4 high school kids, and they were local area kids, and we had it going. Like, it went from last, worst to first immediately, and it was great. And, you know, when you win, it becomes opportunity. Like, it just goes with hand in hand. So we end up winning, and then I called from Central Michigan, and they're looking, Herb Durami is looking to replace Leonard Drake, and I was available. I wasn't looking to leave. I was looking to be at Grand Valley for a while. Like, I was happy as heck. But that came along, and you don't ever know when your Division I opportunity is going to come, Mike. It's just that way. Like, you don't, it could never come. It might come early. It came early for me. So I took over a program. I obviously had one in 14 years. So I told myself, and I think Dick Bent said this, you got to recruit players first that you can lose with first, which meant you've got to get some tough kids. You got to get some guys that love to be there, because you're not going to go into Central Michigan the first year because you're not going to get 5 stars and win. Like, it's just going to take some time. And that's what I did. I tried to bring in solid guys. One's assistant coach at Northwestern. One's a head coach at Oklahoma City College. One's a coach up at Elk Rapids. I got a couple business guys working. They were successful, very successful guys. But we took our lumps for 3 years. We had some good wins, but it was just tough. It was tough treading because we were playing. I started out with 2 walk-ons and 3. I think I started 2 walk-ons, 2 freshmen, and a sophomore. I think that was my starting unit. One was Danny Schell, who I saw in the intramural building playing. I'll never forget. He had tennis shoes on because he was mowing grass, and we were all green in the front of him. And I'm like, oh, man, I'll take that kid right there. He ended up getting drafted by the Brewers for pitcher. He's a pitcher also, but he played basketball. He's the head coach up at Mount Pleasant High School. And a great kid, great guy, good coach. But, you know, he helped us. And I'll never forget, it was my 3rd year. We were 13th. We finished last. It was my 3rd year. We went 4 games. Then we jumped to 11 games. We had freshman of the year, Mike Mansell. David Weber came from Country Day. We all of a sudden went from 4 to 11, had everybody coming back. We started like 3 freshmen again. And then Mike Mansell broke his foot. We didn't have him. And I think we went back to like 7 wins. But we got into a MAC tournament. We were the 13th seed. And we went, we beat Ohio U at Ohio U. So now we're playing Marshall in Cleveland with a chance to get to the semis. And it was like 56-57, and Danny Schell went in for a dunk and missed it to give us the lead with like a minute to go. Or we had to beat Marshall. We ended up losing, I think, by 3 to Marshall. But I knew then, like, we're coming. We just ran out of games. You know, it was one of those things where, like, we finally started to crack it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you just got to grow into it. You got to learn how to lose it to learn how to win it. And we were just growing. We stayed with our guys. The following year, we ended up winning the – we won the whole thing. We won the MAC. We lost in the first game of the – we had the bye. We were the number one seed. We lost to Miami, Ohio, and Charlie Coles in Cleveland because we didn't have our – we had the best sixth man, John Borovich, who's now assistant at Northwestern. He dislocated his shoulder. And he was kind of the – he was like you, Mike. He was just tough, all the intangible things. I mean, he willed us some wins. He had great voice on the court. Just one of the toughest guys I've ever coached. He played the whole year with a torn ACL with a brace on. That's how tough he is.
Wow, that's, yeah.
I mean, tough. Oh, we didn't have him. We got beat. So we graduated those guys, and it was 2 more years after my 6th year. We won it again with Chris Kamen. And that year we won, like, I think we were 25-6 or something. We ended up winning the MAC. We won the conference tournament. And then we got to the NCAA tournament, and we go out to Utah to play. They ship us all the way out to Utah. I'm like, are you kidding me? Why couldn't it be in Indianapolis? Right. Like, if it was Indy, we'd be good. So we go out there. We got to play Kyle Korver and Creighton. And I knew right then, like, we got a shot at these dudes. You know, when you're playing somebody out of the gate, and it's like Syracuse, and they got 12 guys above 7 foot, you know you're in trouble. But Creighton was kind of a mid-major plus, and but we always kept our eye on them all year. We knew they were good. When we got out there, I think we were up 26 in the second half. I mean, we were the – I think they were the 5th seed, and we were like the 13th seed or something. I mean, we ended up winning only by 6, but you knew they were going to make a run at it in the second half. I mean, they got hot, made some shots, but we ended up winning by 6 or 8 or something like that. So after the game, Mike, we're done, and, you know, all of a sudden we're watching. We're going to play the winner of Duke, Colorado State. And we're like, okay, it's going to be Duke, obviously. You know, well, hell, it's like 2 minutes ago, Colorado State's up by like 8. And I'm sitting there going, holy crap. Like, we better start looking at Colorado State here a little bit, boys. I mean, they're up with like a minute to go. They were still up. And I'm like, Buzz Williams was assistant at the time at Colorado State with Dale Lawyer. And works for him now at A&M. And I'm like, holy crap, we got a chance to play Colorado State. They beat Duke. Oh, my God. We got a chance to get to Sweet 16. Well, Duke ended up coming in and, you know, winning at the end, I think, by 3. So we ended up playing Duke. And we went – the long story short, we played Duke. And we had it to, like, 14 at half. But they had – you know, they had Duhon. They had J.J. Riddick. They had Sheldon Williams. They had – who else? Oh gosh, they were loaded. They were really good, and we actually cut it to like 8 in the second half, and then they hit like 4 threes in a row before I could take a timeout. I was like, holy crap, we're down 20 again. So, but it was a great experience. Chris came in that group. I mean, we kind of rode him, you know, the distance, and to have a lottery pick at a school like Central Michigan was special. It was really cool.
Yeah, that's very cool to be able to have somebody who gets to the highest level and plays and then is a part of your team and obviously contributes to your success and then goes on and has a great professional career and plays in the league for what he played, 13 years.
14 so, years.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And he came from a little Class D school. And like I said, nobody really recruited. He came in at 202 pounds and left at 258.
See, there's a lesson there, and I think that's something that, you know, anybody could take. It's, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about just, you know, guys have tools and whatever, and you got to work hard. But the system isn't perfect, and the biggest schools are not always going to find you, and it's sometimes you just get to a place and you develop and you work hard and you grow or you
you know, you put more effort in than other guys, and the talent that maybe was in you that somebody didn't see suddenly blossoms in a certain environment. And I think that that's a great lesson for players out there, that you can, you just got to keep working. And if you keep working, good things are going to happen for you. And good things for you might not be the NBA, but good things just might be you get an opportunity to play college basketball, or maybe you get a chance to start when you didn't think that was going to happen, or maybe you end up being a player that gets some minutes who the year before you never played at all. And I think there's just a tremendous lesson to be learned from the perseverance of going from being a lightly recruited player to being a guy who plays 14 years in the NBA.
No, well, I think, you know, if you'd have went to a Michigan State or a Michigan, I don't think he would have played right away. I'm not going to lie. Like, I don't think he... Yeah, I started in one game his freshman year, and he had a bad game. He's like, I'm not starting. Don't start me. You didn't want to start. All right, we won't start you. And then he started his sophomore year and got more accustomed to it. But it finally clicked for him. But it was one of development. It was one of he got a lot of minutes as a freshman and sophomore and left as a junior as a sixth player in the draft. I mean, I don't think that would have happened if he were at the Michigan State. We threw the ball in 29 times a game. That's a fact. We threw it to him 29. He didn't shoot it all the time, but there was times that he did. I mean, we were 18th in the country in scoring. I was smart enough to put four shooters out there. I know that because you go in there and double, we're shooting threes, and that's what we did. We averaged a little 80 points a game. And, you know, I just don't think that would have happened if Chris would have went to a Michigan State or a Syracuse or something like that. We developed him. We featured him. And those things can happen to you at different schools. It doesn't matter. I think it's like you said, it's the players, the system you play with, you know, working, continue to grind and know that there's going to be some bumps in the road. Like that's, but your ability to adapt and overcome tells a lot about who you are as a person. That's huge to me.
So true. Absolutely true. I want to go and touch on, before we wrap up, I want to touch on your last two stops prior to coming back to Michigan, just briefly, so we can kind of compare and contrast.
Absolutely.
To what you did a little bit earlier in your career. So after you are a head coach, you step away and you go to Detroit Mercy. So just talk a little about the transition from a head coach back to an assistant, and then eventually end up back at the Division III level as a head coach. So I want to touch on the difference between coaching at the Division III level versus where you spent the majority of your career at the Division I level.
Well, before that, my dad had passed away. I lost a player, and assistant coach's wife passed away. So I got out of it for 22 months. Like, I just needed a break. It was 22 straight years. I was grinding it hard. So I went, and believe it or not, I managed a steel service center named Alro Steel up in Grayling, Michigan for 22 months. And then Ray McCallum called me, and the reason my connection with Ray McCallum, we visited Ball State when we were in high school together. And we just said cross paths, and he said, hey, would you think about getting back in it? And I'm like, sure. So I went down and visited Detroit and really liked it. And becoming an assistant was great because, you know, obviously it's less stressful. I didn't have to do all the – I let Ray do all the talking and all the disciplining. And it really, he turned me loose coaching. Like, he let me coach either the offensive, defensive side of the ball, depending on what year it was, and let me do player development. And that's in recruit. I loved it. I did scheduling and, you know, did gear stuff. And that stuff's pretty easy. But I got to really coach. And that's, to me, was what I do. Like, development, skill development, coaching. My niche is kind of with the post players. That's where I made my niche with Chris and Jawan and Eric Riley, and Chris Kamens and Garrett Bergithas. And in fact, even went to Kalamazoo College. My post player broke the shooting percentage record there that was been held for 30 years. Now he's becoming a lawyer at UW-Madison. But it's a change. It's a change where it's suggestions, and you can't have an ego to the point where a coach turns you down. Like, you offer suggestions, he takes or leaves it. A lot of guys I've seen, assistants, man, they get chippy. Like, they get chippy. They don't, like, if they don't take your advice, that's fine. That's okay. Like, move on. Next. And Juwan knows with me, like, I'm going to give you suggestions. You're not going to take all of them. That's okay. Like, I'm good with it in a lot of different ways. Like, he might say, hey, you're crazy, you know? Or I'll give you a quick one with Juwan. Like, I told him, like, we need to put Franz in ball screens. Well, Franz does a ball screen. Wagner does a ball screen. We score in the game. The true story. He scores in the game. So Juwan runs it again, and he turns it over. And he he goes off on me like bleepity bleepity. We're never putting him in a ball screen again. And we laugh about it afterwards. You know, it's like, okay, like it's okay. I laugh about it because it's like, it's all coming from a good place. And I think we as assistant coaches need to know that we offer suggestions to the best of our knowledge with the best information we have and the data that we have. And, you know, you either take or leave it. He's got to do what's in his heart and what's in his gut. And that's kind of where you go with it, with, you know, being an assistant. And we were lucky. We won the Horizon League. We went to the NCAA tournament. We went with the NIT tournament, had some great players. And then we got fired. Been on the other end of it. Got fired. Yeah. Got fired out when we were at the Final Four out in Houston. Like 2014, we got let go out there. And it was funny because we were, heck, we were 15 and 13. I think we were decent. We were in the middle of the pack and we got let go. And all of a sudden you're sitting there with two kids and a wife trying to figure out after, you know, 30 years of coaching what you're going to do. So this is a cool story. So even when I was at Detroit, I interviewed for Kalamazoo College because it's right in downtown Kalamazoo. It's a high academic school, Mike. It's a beautiful campus. It's got good facilities. It's in a cool area. It's a hard academic school, but you got great, great kids. Like, they're all academia. And I interviewed for it because I thought, God, that's a school where they haven't won. And really, my mantra is kind of going into Grand Valleys and the Centrals and Detroits and build a program. Like, build it up. So I you know, didn't have a job, so I interviewed there, and they offered it, and I took it, and I started building, and really, we were just on the cusp. We were 3 points from missing the tournament my third year, so I thought my fourth year, that we have now a chance to try to compete for the MIAA title, kind of like what he did at Central. We had everybody coming back. We missed the MIAA tournament by one 3-pointer, or we'd have made it. And, you know, we had everybody returning. We did not lose one player. So I thought we had a chance to win it the following year. And then all of a sudden, I get a call from Juwan. And, you know, and that's just, it's a special connection. I mean, me and Juwan have been friends. And we had talked in Minnesota in April. Just we met and had lunch with Steve Fisher and Brian Dutcher. I think it's documented out there. You know, we just talked about friendships and everything that's going on. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm in a car going to a funeral, believe it or not. I'm speaking at a funeral, a memorial service. And I get a call from Juwan, and we're talking for 20 minutes. Mike, this is no kidding. We're just chopping it up, talking. We're talking. Nothing's going. He goes, hey, what about you joining my staff? And I'm like, we've been talking for a half hour. You don't even bring it up? Like, like, of course. And I just said, hey, let me get through this funeral. Let me talk to my boss, which is my wife. And I jumped at it. It only took like, I went to the funeral, got done a couple hours. Me and wife talked. And I was coming back to Ann Arbor, and so happy I made the move. And I miss my guys at it. You know, you miss the guys that you recruit at Kalamazoo because they're always special to you. I talked to most of them weekly, but I'm blessed to be at Michigan. It's a special place. Juwan Howard's such a special guy, along with Saadi, Phil Martelli, Chris Hunter, Howard Eisley. We got such a great staff. It's so cool to work with these guys.
All right. Last question. We just blew by the hour and a half mark. So I think we're trying to set the record for our longest pod. I had to send Jason a message of it. He actually had to go get his he's got a 4-month-old at home, so he had to go and relieve his wife for a minute. So he actually disappeared and ghosted on us.
I got you.
But I texted him in the middle. I said, this might have to be the first 2-parter. But let's wrap up with this question, which is just tell us a little bit about what your role is right now, what you're actually doing in your position at Michigan.
Okay. The shortest answer without going too long is anything dealing with the players, I'm involved with. Anything academically, mentally, socially, career-wise, anything doing with our players. My first year, I was trying to get my feet wet. You know, you're trying not to step on toes. You know what I mean? You're trying to find out where the landmines are. What are we lacking? What are we doing? So this past 2 months, we put together a nutrition plan. I put together a career services plan with Julie Feelings. We've talked with Abigail about mental training. So I'm putting those components together to hopefully do kind of in the summertime, 8-week sessions of of player development. I think that's part of player development. The other side, you know, the career stuff, a resume, getting to our Wolverine network, getting on LinkedIn, job shadowing, those types of things. Because our alumni, we have the largest living alumni body in the world. And you're crazy if you don't tap into it. And when you know, Mike, when you're playing, that's the last thing on your mind. Like, you're thinking about, can I get to the league? We're going to play. Sure. We're going to London next year to play Kentucky. That's the last thing. But they'll be glad once they go through it because we're setting them up for success. So if something happens and they don't go to the league, they've made connections with people that can help them in their careers. And I think that's a huge plus for anybody. And that's what you want when you come here. Like, that's what you sign up for. You're part of the Michigan family. So anything dealing with the players, I work with a lady academically, so I handle those. We communicate everything through Google Calendar, so I coordinate that stuff. And then I do a lot of film work. Like, I watch every possession we do. I chart every possession, go through every possession. And I'm able to communicate with Juwan a little differently than most, just the fact that I coached him. And we've known each other for 25 years. Where, you know, Phil's known him for a year, and Sadi's known him for a year. Our relationship is different, so I'm able to bounce some things off him, and he'll ask me, what do you think? Or I'll say, hey, I think we need to look at doing something like this. And whether he takes the idea or not, or I'll say, hey, like I told you, put Franz in a ball screen and get ripped on it. But no, when we get to the locker room, I told him, I said, one of my butt cheeks I'm missing. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, he chewed it off during the game, man. Like, no, stuff like that where we can have fun. And it comes from a good place. And Juwan's such a good person. Like I said, our staff is unbelievable. But, you know, doing those types of things and doing anything we can do. Like, we have orientation coming up June 23rd with our guys. So we're getting them nestled in. We're not going to be in the dorms. So Chris Hunter and myself have set up the Sonesta Suites where our guys will stay, where we eat. All that stuff has to be done. And anything to do with the players, like I said, I got my hands on. And, you know, I just can't be on the floor physically coaching them. I can be at practice. So I have a notepad. You'd be proud of me, Mike. I take notes on everything. I got notes upon notes upon notes on everything. So I'm a big time note taker with it. I just think those things are important so we can document what we're doing and how we're doing it. So, and just trying to be a little piece and try to help the assistant coaches just be a little piece of the pie of success, you know, just try to do my part and try to do it the best of my ability. And, you know, who knows what happens later on, but, you know, for right now, this is where I'm at. This is where I need to be. And this is where the good Lord has put me and has put me back in touch with Juwan here at Michigan.
That's good stuff. I think, I would guess that, although I'm sure you miss the interaction with the players out on the floor, just the nature of the fact that that job is somewhat different than what you've done in the past in terms of your career, I got to imagine that there's some unique challenges and things that you find to be very exciting and fun and different, and that keeps you energized. And obviously, you know, it comes clearly through the microphone, your respect for Juwan as a person and as a coach and the relationship that you guys have, I'm sure makes it doubly special. I think you would attest to the fact that when you're on a coaching staff with guys you get along with good guys, with guys that you're genuinely friends with, it makes the process much more fun when you have those kinds of relationships. And I think that clearly has come across in what we've been able to talk about tonight. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. And I'm so glad that you and I were able to reconnect, forget about the podcast, but just on a personal level. It's amazing how quickly that you can kind of fall back into a relationship that, you know, and you and I were really only together for a year, and the year that you were there, I didn't play a whole lot. And, you know, and yet it still feels like when we picked up the phone before, and then clearly again tonight, it feels like it was just yesterday that we were together. And to me, that's really what it's all about. And I can't thank you enough for being a part of it. Before we get out of here, I want to give you a chance, just share how people can find out more about what you're doing, what is going on with University of Michigan basketball, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Well, I'm on Facebook, Jay Smith. You can find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Coach Jay Smith 45. On Twitter, U of M basketball, you can follow us. My email's out there. More than happy to share whatever it might be. More than happy to help in any way I can, Mike. I'm going to say this, like, it's really cool that we're able to connect. Like, that means more than I think than you know for me. To be able to find you, I saw your podcast before, and then Dave Group called me, which we are still buddies. That you know you're doing something like this to change lives, to help people. It's so cool that you're serving and knowing that maybe we had a little part of that somewhere in there that and you're giving back, and it's really cool. I hope that you'll find now that I did spend 2 hours with you, you better get your butt up here to a game.
Yeah, we're gonna have to do that for sure. There's no doubt. You. Yeah, we're gonna make it happen. We're gonna definitely make that
bring
happen.
Bring the fam, come on up. You'll enjoy it. It's a great experience. Hopefully COVID will be gone by then. Yeah, exactly. Vaccine. You know, but if you hit any of the other guys, please give my love and stuff, man. I'm absolutely. So glad this worked out, Mike, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, the feeling is mutual. Everything that you just said, I could echo that sentiment and double it. It's just been a pleasure getting a chance to reconnect again on a personal level, but also just, I think, the podcast and the stories that you're able to tell and the knowledge that you're able to share with our audience of coaches. I can't thank you enough. It's just been an absolute pleasure. So we appreciate you joining us tonight, and to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.